behind Safi, who marched imperiously up to the first sour-faced guard.
What is the meaning of this?
Safi's words rang out, clear and clipped over the constant din of traffic.
We are now late to our meeting with the Wheat Guild Master. Do you know what his temper is like?
The guard's face settled into a bored glower, but his threads flashed with keen interest.
Names.
Safiya, and this is my lady-in-waiting, Isult.
Though the guard's expression remained unimpressed, his threads flared with more interest. He angled away, motioning for a second guard to loom in close. And Isult had to bite her tongue to keep from warning Safi.
I demand to know what this holdup is for,
Safi cried at the new guard, a giant of a man.
We're looking for two girls, he rumbled. They're wanted for highway robbery. I don't suppose you have any weapons on you.
Do I look like the sort of girl to carry a weapon?
Then you won't mind if we search you.
To Safi's credit, none of the fear in her threads showed on her face, and she only lifted her chin higher.
I most certainly do mind. And if you so much as touch my person, then I will have you fired immediately. All of you.
She thrust out her book, and the first guard flinched.
At this time tomorrow, you'll be on the streets and wishing you hadn't messed with a guildmaster's apprentice.
Safi didn't get to finish her threat, for at that moment a gull screamed overhead, and a splattering of white goo landed on her shoulder. Her threads flashed to turquoise surprise.
No,
she breathed, eyes bulging.
No.
The guard's eyes bulged too, their threads now shimmering into a giddy pink. They erupted with laughter. Then they started pointing, and even Isult had to clap a gloved hand to her mouth.
Don't laugh. Don't laugh.
She started laughing, and Safi's threads blazed into red fury.
Why?
She squawked at Isult, then at the guards.
Why always me?
There are 1,000 shoulders for a gull to crap on, but they always pick me. The guards were doubled over now, and the second one lifted a limp hand.
Go. Just go.
Tears streamed from his eyes, which only served to make Safi snarl as she stomped past.
Why don't you do something useful with your time, instead of laughing at girls in distress? Go fight crime or something.
Then Safi was through the checkpoint and racing for the nearest fat-hulled trade ships, with Isult right on her heels and giggling the entire way. 4. Merrick Nihar's fingers curled around the butter knife. The Karturin Domna across the wide oak dining table had a hairy chin with chicken grease oozing down it. As if sensing Merrick's gaze, the Domna lifted a beige napkin and dabbed at her wrinkled lips and puckered chin. Merrick hated her, just as he hated every other diplomat here. He might have spent years mastering his family's famous temper, yet all it would take at this point was one more grain. One more grain of salt and the ocean would flood. Throughout the long dining room, voices hummed in at least 10 different languages. The Continental Truce Summit would begin tomorrow to discuss the Great War and the close of the 20-year truce. It had brought hundreds of diplomats from across the Witchlands to Vinyatsa City. Dalmari might have been the smallest of the three empires, but it was the most powerful in trade. And since it was neatly situated between the Empire of Marstock in the east and the Karturin Empire to the west, it was the perfect place for these international negotiations. Merrick was here to represent Nubrevna, his homeland. He'd actually arrived 3 weeks earlier, hoping to open new trade, or perhaps re-establish old guild connections. But it had been a complete waste of time. Merrick's eyes flicked from the old noblewoman to the enormous expanse of glass behind her. The gardens of the Doge's palace shone beyond, suffusing the room in a greenish glow and the scent of hanging jasmine. As elected leader of the Dalmati Council, the Doge had no family. No guildmasters in Dalmati did, since families were said to distract them from their devotion to the guilds. So it wasn't as if he needed a garden that could hold 12 of Merrick's ships.
"You are admiring the glass wall?" asked the ginger-haired leader of the Silk Guild, seated on Merrick's right. "It is quite a feat of our earth witches. It's all one pane, you know."
"Quite a feat indeed," Merrick said, though his tone suggested otherwise.
"Although, I wonder, Guildmaster Alex, if you've ever considered a more useful occupation for your earth witches."
The guildmaster coughed lightly.
"Our witches are highly specialized individuals. Why insist that an earth witch who is good with soil only work on a farm? But there is a difference between a soil witch who can only work with soil and an earth witch who chooses to only work with soil, or with melting sand into glass."
Merrick leaned back in his chair.
"Take yourself, Guildmaster Alex. You are an earth witch, I presume? Likely your magic extends to animals, yet certainly it's not exclusive to only silkworms." "Ah, but I am not an earth witch at all."
Alex flipped his hand slightly, revealing his witch mark. A circle for ether and a dashed line that meant he specialized in art.
"I am a tailor by trade.
My magic lies in bringing a person's spirit to life in clothing."
"Of course," Merrick answered flatly.
The Silk Guildmaster had just proven Merrick's point. Not that the man seemed to notice. Why waste a magical skill with art on fashion? On a single type of fabric? Merrick's own tailor had done a plenty fine job with the linen suit he now wore. No magic necessary. A long silver-gray frock coat covered a cream shirt. And though both pieces had more buttons than ought to be legal, Merrick liked the suit. His fitted black breeches were tucked into squeaking new boots, and the wide belt at his hips was more than mere decoration. Once Merrick was back on his ship, he would refasten his cutlass and pistols. Clearly sensing Merrick's displeasure, Guildmaster Alex shifted his attention to the noblewoman on his other side.
"What say you to Emperor Henrik's pending marriage, my lady?"
Merrick's frown deepened. All anyone seemed interested in discussing at this luncheon was gossip and frivolities. There was a man in the former Republic of Erythawania, that wild, anarchical land to the north, who was uniting raider factions and calling himself king. But did these imperial diplomats care? Not at all. There were rumors that the Hellbard Brigade was pressing witches into service. Yet not a one of these domes or domnas seemed to find this news alarming. Then again, Merrick supposed it wasn't their sons or daughters who would be forced to enlist. Merrick's furious gaze dropped back to his plate. It was scraped clean. Even the bones had been swept into his napkin. Bone broth, after all, was easy to make and could feed sailors for days. Several of the other luncheon guests had noticed. Merrick hadn't exactly hidden it when he used the beige silk to pluck the bones off his plate. Merrick was even tempted to ask his nearest neighbors if he could have their chicken bones, most of which were untouched and surrounded by green beans. Sailors didn't waste food. Not when they never knew if they would catch another fish or see land again. And especially not when their homeland was starving.
"Admiral," said a fat nobleman to Merrick's left, "how is King Seraphin's health? I heard his wasting disease was in its final stages."
"Then you heard wrong," Merrick answered, his voice dangerously cool for anyone who knew the Nihar family rage. "My father is improving. Thank you. What's your name again?"
The man's cheeks jiggled.
Dom Philip von Grieg.
He pasted on a fake smile.
Grieg is one of the largest holdings in the Kartoran Empire. Surely you know of it. Or do you? I suppose a new Brevnend would have no need for Kartoran geography.
Merrick merely smiled at that. Of course he knew where the Grieg holdings were. But let the Dome think him ignorant to Kartoran specifics.
I have 3 sons in the Hellbard Brigade, the Dome continued,
his thick, sausage-like fingers reaching for a goblet of wine.
The Emperor has promised them each a holding of their own in the near future.
You don't say.
Merrick was careful to keep his face impassive, but in his head he was roaring his fury. The Hellbard Brigade, that elite contingent of ruthless fighters tasked with cleansing Kartora of elemental witches and heretics. They were one of the primary reasons that Merrick hated Kartorans. After all, Merrick was an elemental witch, as was almost every person in the Witchlands that he cared about. As Don von Grieg sipped from his goblet, a stream of expensive Dalmati wine dribbled out the sides of his mouth. It was wasteful. Disgusting. Merrick's fury grew and grew and grew. Until it was the final grain of salt. And Merrick succumbed to the flood. With a sharp, rasping inhale, he drew the air in the room to himself. Then he huffed it out. Wind blasted at the dome. The man's goblet tipped up. Wine splattered his face, his hair, his clothes. It even flew to the window, splattering red droplets across the glass. Silence descended. For half a second, Merrick considered what he ought to do now. An apology was clearly out of the question, and a threat seemed too dramatic. Then, Merrick's eyes caught on Guildmaster Alex's uncleared plate. Without a second thought, Merrick shoved to his feet and swept a stormy glare over the noble faces now gawking at him, at the wide-eyed servants hovering in the doorways and shadows. Then, Merrick snatched the napkin from the Guildmaster's lap.
You're not going to eat that, are you?
Merrick didn't wait for an answer. He merely murmured,
Good, good, because my crew most certainly will, and set to gathering up the bones, the green beans, and even the final bits of stewed cabbage.
After wrapping the silk napkin tight, he thrust it into his waistcoat pocket along with his own saved bones. Then he turned to the blinking Dalmati Doge and declared,
Thank you for your hospitality, my lord.
And with nothing more than a mocking salute, Merrick Nihar, Prince of New Brevna and Admiral to the New Brevnan Navy, marched from the Doge's luncheon, the Doge's dining room, and finally the Doge's palace. And as he walked, he began to plan. By the time Merrick reached the southernmost point of the Southern Wharf District, distant chimes were ringing in the 15th hour and the tide was out. The heat of the day had sunk into the cobblestones, leaving a miserable warmth to curl up from the streets. When Merrick attempted to hop a puddle of only Noden knew what, he failed, and his new boots caught the edge of it. Blackened water splashed up, carrying with it the heavy stench of old fish. And Merrick fought the urge to punch in the nearest shop window. It wasn't the city's fault that its guildmasters were buffoons. In the 19 years and 4 months since the 20-year truce had stopped all war in the Witchlands, the 3 empires, Kartora, Marstock, and Dalmati, had successfully crushed Merrick's home through diplomacy. Each year, one less trade caravan had passed through his country, and one less New Brevnan export had found a buyer. New Brevna wasn't the only small nation to have suffered. Supposedly, the Great War had started all those centuries ago, as a dispute over who owned the 5 origin wells. In those days, it was the wells that chose the rulers, something to do with the 12 paladins. Although how 12 knights or an inanimate spring could choose a king, Merrick had never quite understood. It was all the stuff of legends now, anyway, and over the decades and eventually the centuries, 3 empires grew from the Great War's mayhem, and each empire wanted the same thing. More. More witcheries, more crops, more ports. So then it was 3 massive empires against a handful of tiny fierce nations. Tiny fierce nations who slowly got the upper hand. For wars cost money, and even empires can run out. Peace, the Kartoran Emperor had proclaimed. Peace for 20 years and then a renegotiation. It had sounded perfect. Too perfect. What people like Merrick's mother hadn't realized when they'd penned their names on the 20-year truce was that when Emperor Henrik said peace, he really meant pause. And when he said renegotiation, he meant ensuring these other nations fall beneath us when our armies resume their march. So now, as Merrick watched the Delmati armies roll in from the west, the Marstaki fire witches gather in the east, and 3 Imperial navies slowly float toward his homeland's coast, it felt like Merrick and all of New Brevna were drowning. They were sinking beneath the waves, watching the sunlight vanish, until there would be nothing left but Noden's hagfishes and a final lungful of water. But the New Brevnans weren't crippled yet. Merrick had one more meeting, this one with the Gold Guild. If Merrick could just open one line of trade, then he felt certain other guilds would follow. When at last Merrick reached his warship, a 3-masted frigate with the sharp, beak-like bow distinctive to New Brevnan naval ships, he found her calm upon the low tide. Her sails were furled, her oars stowed, and the New Brevnan flag, with its black background and bearded iris, a vivid flash of blue at the flag's center, flew languidly on the afternoon breeze. As Merrick marched up the gangway onto the Jana, his temper settled slightly, only to be replaced by shoulder-tensing anxiety and the sudden need to check if his shirt was properly tucked in. This was Merrick's father's ship. Half the men were King Seraphin's crew, and despite 3 months with Merrick in charge, these men weren't keen on having Merrick around. A towering ash-haired figure loped over the main deck toward Merrick. He dodged several swabbing sailors, stretched his long legs over a crate, and then swept a stiff bow before his prince. It was Merrick's thread brother, Cullen Icrae, who was also first mate on the Jana.
"You're back early," Cullen said.
When he rose, Merrick didn't miss the red spots on Cullen's pale cheeks, or the slight hitch in his breath. It meant the possibility of a breathing attack.
"Are you ill?"
Merrick asked, careful to keep his voice low. Cullen pretended not to hear, though the air around them chilled. A sure sign Cullen wanted to drop the subject. At first glance, nothing about Merrick's thread brother seemed particularly fit for life at sea. He was too tall to fit comfortably below decks. His fair skin burned with shameful ease, and he wasn't fond of swordplay. Not to mention, his thick white eyebrows showed far too much expression for any respectable seaman. But by Noden, if Cullen couldn't control a wind. Unlike Merrick, Cullen's elemental magic wasn't exclusive to air currents. He was a full air witch, able to control a man's lungs, able to dominate the heat and the storms, and once, he'd even stopped a full-blown hurricane. Witches like Merrick were common enough, and with varying degrees of mastery over the wind. But as far as Merrick knew, Cullen was the only living person with complete control over all aspects of the air. Yet it wasn't Cullen's magic that Merrick most valued. It was his mind, sharp as nails, and his steadiness, constant as the tide to the sea.
"How was the lunch?"
Cullen asked, the air around him warming as he bared his usual terrifying smile. He wasn't very good at smiling.
"It was a waste of time," Merrick replied.
He marched over to deck, his boot heels clacking on the oak. Sailors paused to salute, their fists pounding their hearts. Merrick nodded absently at each. Then he remembered something in his pocket. He withdrew the napkins and handed them off to Cullen. Several breaths passed. Then,
"Leftovers."
"I was making a point," Merrick muttered, and his footsteps clipped out harder.
"A stupid point that missed its mark. Is there any word from Lovatz?" "Yes, but,"
Cullen hastened to add, hands lifting,
"it had nothing to do with the king's health. All I heard was that he's still confined to bed."
Frustration tugged at Merrick's shoulders. He hadn't heard any specifics about his father's disease in weeks.
"And my aunt, is she back from the healers?" "Hi."
"Good," Merrick nodded, at least satisfied with that.
"Send Aunt Yvraine to my cabin. I want to ask her about the Gold Guild."
He trailed off, feet grinding to a halt.
"What is it? You only squint at me like that when something's wrong."
"Hi," Cullen acknowledged, scratching at the back of his neck. His eyes flicked toward the massive wind drum on the quarterdeck. A new recruit, whose name Merrick could never remember, was cleaning the drum's two mallets. The magicked mallet, for producing cannon-like bursts of wind. The standard mallet, for messages and shanty beats.
"We should discuss it in private,"
Cullen finally finished.
"It's about your sister. Something arrived for her."
Merrick smothered an oath, and his shoulders rose higher. Ever since Seraphin had named Merrick as the Truce Summit's New Brevenan envoy, meaning he was also temporarily Admiral of the Royal Navy, Vivia had tried a thousand different ways to seize control from afar. Merrick stomped into his cabin, footsteps echoing off the whitewashed ceiling beams as he aimed for the screwed-down bed in the right corner. Cullen, meanwhile, moved to the long table for charts and bookkeeping at the center of the room. It was also bolted down, and a 3-inch rim kept papers from flying during rough seas. Sunlight cut through windows all around, reflecting on King Seraphin's sword collection, meticulously displayed on the back wall. The perfect place for Merrick to accidentally touch one in his sleep and leave permanent fingerprints. At the moment, this ship might have been Merrick's, but Merrick had no illusions that it would stay that way. During times of war, the queen ruled the land and the king ruled the seas. Thus, the Janna was Merrick's father's ship, named after the dead queen, and it would be Seraphin's ship once more when he healed. If he healed. And he had to. Otherwise, Vivia was next in line for the throne. And that wasn't something Merrick wanted to imagine yet. Or deal with. Vivia was not the sort of person content with only ruling land or sea. She wanted control of both, and beyond, and she made no effort to pretend otherwise. Merrick knelt beside his only personal item on the ship, a trunk, roped tightly to the wall. After a quick rummage, he found a clean shirt and his storm-blue admiral's uniform. He wanted to get out of his dress suit as quickly as possible, for there was nothing to deflate a man's ego like a bit of frill around the collar. As Merrick's fingers undid the 10 million buttons on his dress shirt, he joined Cullen at the table. Cullen had opened a map of the Jadansi Sea, the slip of ocean that bisected the Dalmati Empire.
This is what came for Vivia.
He plunked down a miniature ship that looked identical to the Dalmati Guild ships listing outside. It slid across the map, locking in place over Vinyatsa City.
Obviously, it's ether-witched, and will move wherever its corresponding ship sails.
Cullen's eyes flicked up to Merrick's.
According to the scumbag who delivered it, the corresponding ship is from the Wheat Guild.
And why?
Merrick began, giving up on his buttons and just yanking the shirt over his head.
Does Vivia care about a trade ship?
He tossed it at his trunk and planted his hands on the table. His faded witch mark stretched into an unbalanced diamond.
What does she expect us to do with it?
Foxes, Cullen said, and the room turned icy.
Foxes,
Merrick repeated, the word knocking around without meaning in his skull. Then, suddenly, it sifted into place, and he burst into action, spinning for his trunk.
That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard from her, and she's said plenty of stupid things in her life. Tell Herman to contact Vivia's voice witch. Now. I want to talk with her at the next ring of the chime.
Hi.
Cullen's footsteps rang out as Merrick yanked out the first shirt his fingers touched. He tugged it on as the cabin door swung wide and then clicked shut. At that sound, Merrick gritted his teeth and fought to keep his temper. Locked up tight. This was so typically Vivia. So why the hell should Merrick be surprised or angry? Once upon a time, the foxes had been Nubrevnan pirates. Their tactics had relied on small half-galleys. They were shallower than the Jana, with two masts and oars that allowed them to slip between sandbars and barrier islands with ease, and allowed them to ambush larger ships. But the fox standard, a serpentine sea fox coiling around the bearded iris, hadn't flown the masts in centuries. It hadn't needed to once Nubrevna had possessed a true navy of its own. As Merrick stood there trying to imagine any sort of argument his sister might listen to, something flickered outside the nearest window. Yet other than waves piling against the high-water mark and a merchant ship rocking next door, there was nothing unusual. Except it wasn't high tide. Merrick darted for the window. This was Vinyatsa City, a city of marshes, and there were only two things that would bring in an unnatural tide, an earthquake or magic. And there was only one reason a witch would summon waves to a wharf. Cleaving. Merrick sprinted for the door.
Cullen!
He roared as his feet hit the main deck. The waves were already licking higher, and the Jana had begun to list. Two ships north, a hulking sailor staggered down a trade ship's gangplank toward the cobblestoned street. He scratched furiously at his forearms, at his neck. And even at this distance, Merrick could see the black pustules bubbling on the man's skin. Soon, his magic would reach its breaking point, and he would feast on the nearest human life. The waves swept in higher, rougher, summoned by the cleaving witch. Though several people noticed the man and screeched their terror, most couldn't see the waves, couldn't hear the screams. They were unaware and unprotected. So Merrick did the only thing he could think of. He shouted once more for Cullen, and then he gathered in his magic, so it would lift him high and carry him far. Moments later, in a gust of air, Merrick took flight.
5.
Safi's temper was on the verge of exploding, what with the gull crap on her shoulder, the oppressive afternoon heat, and the fact that not one of the six ships on this dock needed new workers, especially not ones dressed as guild apprentices. Isolt glided ahead, already at the end of the dock and joining the wharfside throngs. Even from this distance, Safi could see Isolt fidgeting with her scarf and gloves as she scrutinized something in the murky water. Eyebrows high, Safi directed her own gaze to the brackish waves. There was a charge in the air. It pricked at the hair on her arms and sent a chill fingering down her spine. Then her truth witchery exploded, a coating, scraping sensation against her neck that heralded wrongness. Huge, vast wrongness. Someone's magic was cleaving. Safi had felt it once before. Felt her power swell as if it might cleave too. Anyone with a witchery could sense it coming. Could feel the world falling out of its magical order. Of course, if you didn't have magic, like most of these people streaming down the dock, then you might as well be dead already. A shout split Safi's ears like thunder. Isolt! Mid-stride and with a roar for people to stand aside, Safi dove forward, curled her chin to her chest, and rolled. As her body tumbled over the wood, she grabbed for the parrying dagger in her boot. It was for defense against a sword, but it was still sharp. And it could still gut a man if needed. As the momentum of the roll drove Safi back to her feet, she dragged the knife down, and in a quick slash, she shredded her skirts. Then she was sprinting once more, her legs free to pump as high as she needed, and her knife in hand. The waves curled higher, harder, gusts of power that grated against Safi's skin like a thousand lies told at once. The cleaved man's magic must be connected to water, and now the trade ships were heaving, heaving, creaking, creaking, and then crashing against the pier. Safi reached the stone key. In half a breath, she took in the scene. A cleaved tide witch, his skin rippling with the oil of festered magic, and blood black as pitch dribbling from a cut on his chest. Only paces away, Isolt was low in her stance, her skirts ripped through as well. "That's my girl," Safi thought. And to the left, flying through the air with all the grace of an untested, broken-winged bat, was some sort of air witch. His hands were out as he called the wind to carry him. Safi had only two thoughts. "Who the rot is that new Brevnan wind witch?" And, "He should really learn how to button a shirt." Then the shirtless man touched down directly in her path. She shrieked as loud as she could, but all she got was an alarmed glance before she flung her knife aside and slammed into his body. They crashed to the ground, and the young man shoved her off, shouting, "Stay back! I'll handle this!" Safi ignored him. He was clearly an idiot. And in more time than it ought to take, she disentangled herself from the Nubrevnin and snatched up her dagger. She spun toward the cleaving tide witch. Just as Isolt closed in, a swirl of steel meant to attract the eye, but it was having no effect. The tide witch didn't lurch out of the way. Isolt's scythes beat into his stomach, and more black blood sprayed. Blackened organs toppled out too. Then water erupted onto the street. Ships rammed against the stones in a deafening crunch of wood. A second wave charged in, and right behind it, a third.
"Colin," the new Brevnan bellowed from behind Safi, "hold back the water!"
In an explosion of magic that rushed across Safi's body, air funneled toward the encroaching waves. The magicked wind hit the water, waves toppled and foamed backward. But the cleaving tide witch didn't care. His blackened eyes had latched onto Safi now. His blood-stained hands clawed up, and he barreled toward her like a squall. Safi sprang into a flying kick. Her heel crashed into his ribs. He toppled forward right as Isolt spun into a hook kick. Her boot pummeled the man's chin.
shifted the angle of his fall. He hit the cobblestones. Black pustules burst all over his skin, splattering the street with his blood. But he was still alive, still conscious. With a roar like a hurricane, he struggled to get upright. That was when the New Brevnan man decided to reappear. He sidled close to the cleaved, and Safi's panic burned up her throat.
"What are you doing?"
"I told you I'd handle this," he bellowed.
Then his arms flung back, and in a surge of power that sparked through Safi's lungs, his cupped hands hit the cleaved sailor's ears. Air exploded through the man's brain. His blackened eyes rolled backward. The Tide Witch crumpled to the street. Dead. Isolde swept aside her skirts and shoved her moonscythes back into their concealed calf scabbards. Nearby, Dalmatis made frantic two-fingered swipes across their eyes. It was a sign to ward off evil, to ask their gods to protect their souls. Some aimed their movements at the dead cleaved, but more than a few aimed the swipe at Isolde, as if she had any interest in claiming their souls. She did, however, have an interest in not being mobbed and beaten today. So, twisting toward the dead Tide Witch, she readjusted her headscarf and thanked the Moon Mother it hadn't been removed in the fight. She also thanked the goddess that no one else had cleaved. Such a powerful burst in magic could easily send other witches over the brink, a brink from which there was no return. Though no one knew what made a person cleave, Isolde had read theories that linked the corruption to the 5 origin wells spread across the Witchlands. Each well was linked to one of the 5 elements: ether, earth, water, wind, or fire. Though people spoke of a void element, and of void witches like that blood witch, there was no record of an actual void well. Perhaps a void well was out there, but it had been long forgotten. The springs that had fed it were dried up. The trees that had blossomed year-round were shriveled to desiccated husks. Such stagnation had certainly happened with the earth, wind, and water wells, and perhaps they, too, would one day be lost to history. No matter the well's fates, though, scholars didn't think it mere coincidence that the only witcheries to cleave were those linked to earth, wind, or water. And if the Carowen monks were to be believed, then only the return of the Kar-Awen could ever heal the dead wells or the cleaved. Well, Isolde didn't think that would be happening anytime soon. No return of the Kar-Awen, and no escaping all these hateful stares either. Once Isolde felt certain that her hair was sufficiently covered, her face sufficiently shaded, and her sleeves sufficiently low enough to hide her pale skin, she reached for Safi's threads so she could find her thread sister among the crowds. But her eyes and her magic caught something off. Threads like she'd never seen before. Directly beside her, on the corpse. Her gaze slid to the cleaved man's body. Blackened blood, and perhaps something else oozed from his ears, between the cobblestones. The pustules on his body had erupted. Some of that oily spray was on Isolde's slashed skirts and sweaty bodice. And yet, though the man was undoubtedly dead, there were still 3 threads wriggling over his chest. Like maggots, they shimmied and coiled inward. Short threads. The threads that break. It shouldn't have been possible. Isolde's mother had always told her that the dead have no threads, and in all the Nomatsi burning ceremonies Isolde had attended as a child, she had never seen threads on a corpse. The longer Isolde gaped, the more the crowds closed in. Speculators curious over the body were everywhere. And Isolde had to squint to see through their threads, to tamp down on all the emotions around her. Then one crimson raging thread flashed nearby, and with it came a waspish snarl.
Who the hell flames do you think you are? We had that under control.
Under control,
retorted a male voice with a sharp accent.
I just saved your lives.
Are you cleaved?
Safi cried, and Azult winced at the poor word choice. But of course, Safi was venting her grief, her terror, her explosive threads. She was always like this when something bad, truly bad, happened. She either ran from her emotions as fast as her legs would carry her, or she beat them into submission. When at last Azult popped out beside her thread sister, it was just in time to see Safi grab a fistful of the young man's unbuttoned shirt.
Is this how all new Brevnans dress?
Safi snatched the other side of his shirt.
These go inside these.
To his credit, the new Brevnan didn't move. His face simply flushed a wild scarlet, as did his threads, and his lips pressed tight.
I know, he gritted out, how a button operates. He knocked Safi's wrists away. And I don't need advice from a woman with bird shit on her shoulder.
Oh, no,
Isolt thought, lips parting to warn. Fingers clamped on Isolt's arm. Before she could flip up her hand and snap the wrist of her grabber, the person flipped up her wrist and shoved it against her back. And a thread of clayish red pulsed in Isolt's vision. It was a familiar shade of annoyance that spoke of years enduring Safi's tantrums, which meant Habim had arrived. The Marstaki man shoved Isolt's wrist harder to her back and snarled,
Walk, Isolt, to that cat's alley over there.
You can let me go,
she said, voice toneless. She could just see Habim from the corner of her eyes. He wore the Hastral family's gray and blue livery.
Void witch! You called me a void witch! I speak New Brevnan, you horse's ass!
The rest of Safi's bloodthirsty screams were in New Brevnan and swallowed up by the crowds. Isolt hated when Safi's threads got so bright they blazed over everything else. When they seared into Isolt's eyes, into her heart. But Habim didn't slow as he guided Isolt around a one-legged beggar singing Eurydice's lament. Then they'd reached a narrow slip of space between a dingy tavern and an even dingier second-hand shop. Isolt staggered into it. Her boots kicked through unseen puddles and the stench of cat piss burned in her skull. She shook out her wrist and spun back to her mentor. This behavior wasn't like the gentle Habim. He was a deadly man, certainly. He had served Aaron von Hastral for 2 decades as a man-at-arms. But Habim was also soft-spoken and careful, cool, and in control of his temper. At least he was normally.
What, he began, marching at Isolt, were you doing? Pulling your weapons out like that. Hell gates, Isolt. You should have run.
That cleaving tide witch, she began.
But Habim only stomped in closer. He was not a tall man, and his eyes had been level with his ults for the past 3 years. Right now, those line-seamed eyes were rounded with his ire, and his threads glittered an irate red.
Any cleaved are the city guard's problem, and the guards are now your problem. Highway robbery, Isolt.
Her breath hitched.
How did you find out?
There are blockades everywhere. Matthew and I met one on our way into the city, only to learn that the city guards are looking for 2 girls, one with a sword and one with moon scythes. How many people do you think fight with moon scythes, Isolt?
Those,
Habim pointed at her scabbards,
are obvious. And as a nomadzi, you have no legal protection in this country,
and simply carrying a weapon in public will get you hanged.
Habim pivoted on his heel to march away 3 steps, then back 3 steps.
Think, Isolde. Think.
Isolde compressed her lips.
Stasis. Stasis in your fingertips and in your toes.
In the distance, she could just hear the growing roll of snare drums that meant the Vinyatsa city guards were on their way. They would behead the Tide Witch's body as required by law for all cleaved corpses.
Are you done screaming at me?
She asked at last, her old stammer grabbing her tongue, distorting her words.
Because I need to get back to Safi, and we need to leave the city.
Habim's nostrils fluttered with a deep inhale, and Isolde watched as he pushed aside his emotions, as the lines of his face smoothed out and his threads turned calm.
You cannot go back to Safi. In fact, you will not leave this alley by the way you came in. Guildmaster Yotoluzzi has a blood witch in his employ, and that creature is straight from the void with no mercy or fear.
Habim shook his head, and the first hints of gray fear twined into his threads, which only made Isolde's throat clog tighter. Habim was never scared.
Blood witch. Blood witch.
Safi's uncle is in town. Habim went on, for the truce summit. So,
Dom van Hastrel is here?
Isolde's jaw slackened. Habim could have said 1,000 things, but none would have surprised her more. She'd met the battle-scarred Aaron 2 times in the past, and his sloppy inebriation had instantly verified all of Safi's stories and complaints.
All Kartorin nobility are required to be here,
Habim explained, falling back into his 3-step pace, left, right.
Henrik has some grand announcement to make, and in his usual fashion, he's using this summit as his stage.
Isolde was scarcely listening.
Does all the nobility include Safi?
Habim's expression softened. His threads flickered to a gentle peach tenderness.
That includes Safi. Which means she currently has her uncle and an entire court of domes and domnas to protect her from Yotoluzzi's blood witch. But you...
Habim didn't have to utter the rest. Safi had her title to protect her, and Isolde had her heritage to damn her. Isolde's hands lifted, rubbed her cheeks, her temples. But her fingers were only a distant sensation of pressure on her skin. Just as the crowds were a throbbing hum, and the rattle of the guards' drums a low hiss.
So what can I do?
She asked at last.
I can't afford passage on a boat. And even if I could, I have nowhere to go.
Habim waved to the end of the alley.
There's an inn called the Hawthorne Canal a few blocks away. I've hired a room and a horse there. You'll stay overnight, and then, tomorrow at sunset, you can travel to the Hawthorne Canal's sister inn on the north side. Matthew and I will be waiting for you. In the meantime, we'll deal with the Blood Witch.
Why only one night, though? What could possibly happen in one night?
For a long breath, Habim stared so intently it was as if he could read Isolde's threads, as if he could search her for truth or lies.
Safi was born a domna. You have to remember that, Isolde. All her training has been toward that one thing. Tonight, she is needed at the truce summit. Henrik has openly demanded her presence, which means she cannot refuse. And it means you cannot stand in her way.
With those simple words, you cannot stand in her way, Isolde's breath hardened in her lungs. For all that Safi might have lost their savings, and for all that a blood witch might have latched onto their trail, Isolde had still believed that everything would blow over. That this snarl in the loom would somehow untangle, and life would return to normal in a few weeks. But this felt like the end. Safi was going to have to be a domna, plain and simple, and there was no room for Isolde in that life.
Loss,
she thought vaguely, as she tried to identify the feeling in her chest.
This must be loss.
I've told you this before, Habim said gruffly, his gaze raked up and down, like a general inspecting a soldier. 100 times I've told you, Isolde, yet you never listen to me. You never believe. Why did Matthew and I encourage your friendship with Safi? Why did we decide to train you alongside her?
Isolde squeezed the air from her chest, willing the thoughts and the shame to ebb away.
Because, she recited, no one can protect Safi like her Thread family.
Exactly. Thread family bonds are unbreakable. And you know that better than anyone else. The day that you saved Safi's life 6 years ago, you and she were bound together as Thread sisters. To this day, you would die for Safi, just as she would die for you. So do this for her, Isolde. Hide away for the night. Let Matthew and I deal with the Blood Witch, and then return to Safi's side tomorrow.
A pause. Then Isolde nodded gravely.
Quit being a fanciful fool,
she chided herself, exactly as her mother had always done. This wasn't the end at all, and Isolde should have been smart enough to see that right away.
Give me your scythes, Habim ordered. I'll return them to you tomorrow.
They're my only weapons.
Yes, but you're Nomadzi. If you get stopped at another blockade, we can't risk it.
Isolde gave a rough scrub at her nose, and then muttered,
Fine,
before unstrapping her prized blades. Almost childishly, she thrust them at Habim. His threads flickered with a sad blue as he moved deeper into the alley and swooped up a waxed canvas bag from the shadows. He withdrew a rough black blanket.
This is salamander fiber.
He draped it over Isolde's head and shoulders and fastened it with a simple pin.
As long as you wear this, the Blood Witch can't smell you. Do not remove it until we're together tomorrow night.
Isolde nodded. The stiff fabric resisted the movement. And Moon Mother save her, it was hot. Habim then reached into his pocket and plunked out a sack of clinking coins.
This should cover the cost of the inn and a horse.
After accepting the piastres, Isolde turned to a dilapidated door. The sounds of chopping knives and boiling pots drifted through the wood, yet her hand paused on the rusted doorknob. This felt wrong. What sort of Thread sister would Isolde be if she left Safi without a goodbye? Or at least a backup plan for those inevitable worst-case scenarios?
Can you give Safi a message?
Isolde asked, keeping her words calm. At Habim's nod, she continued.
Tell Safi that I'm sorry I had to go, and that she'd better not lose my favorite book, and... Oh!
Isolde raised her eyebrows, feigning an afterthought.
Please tell her not to slit your throat, since I'm sure she'll try to once she finds out you've sent me away.
I'll tell her, Habim said, voice and threads solemn. Now, hurry. That Blood Witch is no doubt on his way right now.
Isolde bowed her head once, a soldier to her general, before yanking open the door and marching into the steamy, crowded kitchen. 6. As the snare drums approached, Safi's wrath riled higher and higher. The only reason she didn't chase after that cursed New Brevnan as he strode toward his ship, with his shirt still unbuttoned, was because the tallest, palest man she'd ever seen marched beside him. And because Safi had lost sight of Isolde. But her frantic search for her thread sister was interrupted when the footsteps and the drumbeats of the approaching guard cut off. When the crowds along the pier fell silent. A slice, a thunk, a splatter. For a long moment, the only sounds were the pigeons, the breeze, and the calm waves. Then a strangled sob. Someone who'd known the dead man, perhaps, cut the silence like a serrated knife. It echoed in Safi's ears, shook in her rib cage. A minor chord to fill a hole left behind. A hand landed on Safi's bicep. Habim.
This way, Safi. There's a carriage.
I need to find Isolde, she said, unmoving, unblinking.
She's gone somewhere safe.
Habim's expression was grim, but that was nothing unusual.
I promise, he added.
And Safi's magic whispered, true. A warm purr in her chest. So, stiff as a ship's mast, Safi followed Habim to a nondescript covered carriage. Once she was seated within, he shut the door and yanked a heavy black curtain over the window. Then, in curt tones, Habim explained how he and Matthew had recognized the girls by their weapons and had shortly thereafter found Matthew's destroyed shop. Shame crept up Safi's neck as she listened. Matthew was more than just her tutor. He was family. And now, Safi's mistakes had ruined his home. Yet when Habim mentioned sending Isolde to an inn, alone, unprotected, all of the afternoon's horror was swallowed up by skull-rattling rage. Safi dove for the door. Habim had her in a stranglehold before she could even twist the knob.
If you open that door, he growled, the Blood Witch will smell you. If you keep it shut, however, then the monk can't trace you. That curtain is made of salamander fiber, Safi, and Isolde is wearing a cloak of the same fabric right now.
Safi froze, her vision crossing from lack of air and the scarred back of Habim's right hand blurring. She couldn't believe Isolde had simply walked away without a fight, without Safi. It made no sense. Yet Safi's magic shouted in her ribcage that it was true. So, she nodded. Habim released her, and she straggled into her seat. Habim had always been the more tightly keyed of her mentors. A chime piece wound faster than the rest of the world. And it left him without patience for Safi's impulsiveness.
I know this holdup was your doing, Safi.
Habim's soft voice somehow filled every space of the carriage.
Only you would be so reckless. And then Isolde followed you as she always does.
Safi didn't argue with that. It was undeniably true. The card game might have been Isolde's idea, yet every single bad decision since could be laid at Safi's doorstep.
This mistake, Habim continued, has complicated, possibly ruined, 20 years of planning. Now, with Eren here, we're doing what we can to salvage the situation.
Safi stiffened. Uncle Eren? She repeated. Here? As Habim offered up some story about Henrik summoning all the Kartoran nobility for a grand announcement, Safi forced herself to mimic Habim. To settle back and relax. She needed to think through everything like Isolde always did. She needed to analyze her opponents and her terrain. But analyzing and strategy weren't her strengths. Every time she tried to organize the pieces of her day, they swung apart and were that much harder to reassemble. The only thought she could keep pinned down was, Uncle Eren is here.
Vinyatsa City.
She hadn't seen him in 2 years. She'd hoped she would never have to again. Simply thinking of Aaron reminded